The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war.
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Hello and welcome to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Our guest today is Herman Obermeyer, author of the recent book Soldiering for Freedom, A GI's Account of World War II. I want to start with the remarkable collection of letters that had been saved in your family for so many years, I guess languishing in an attic at some point until you rediscovered them. I think it's a treasure trove, the likes of which I don't recall seeing anything that comprehensive in one place that goes back that far and lasts that long.
Thank you. It is unusual. It's unusual. Its survival is one bit of uniqueness. The uniqueness that I had very literate, erudite parents who wrote, my mother wrote to me daily and my father once a week. And I was expected to write three letters a week. And I did, and because they performed on their end of the bargain. And to write three letters a week means you have to think about things beyond that I walked 9 miles today and I'm tired and the lieutenant's a fool. You had to comment on war, on why lieutenants, why you didn't necessarily respect your officers, what was all involved. And they wrote in literate sentences and paragraphs, and they expected me to write about ideas the same way and responded. And I think that's part of the uniqueness, that you had the basis for an exchange of letters that went beyond the normal chronicle of the events.
Well, I must say as well that the letters are awfully mature for somebody who was your age then. You don't often get an account like this from the ground from somebody who was there, because it's mainly, as someone wrote, I think, in a review of your book, it's usually the fog of war, not the cog of war, that we hear about.
I agree. One of the unique things about letters, war letters or love letters or Lord Chesterfield's letters to his son, all have the presumption of transience. Almost journalism, history, any kind of reports, all have the presumption that they're going to be read in the future, even a diary. A letter, you presume, is going to be thrown out after one or two readings. Therefore, there's more candor in letters than there is in almost any other form of communication. And so, therefore, letters disclose in a way that no other form of writing does differently. John Adams' letters are unique, because his wife was a literate woman and they exchanged letters and described the period in which they lived in a way that almost no other person did. His role in the revolution has become much clearer because Abigail Adams was an excellent correspondent than for many of his contemporaries like Jefferson, who obviously was a superb writer and wrote Declaration of Independence, but didn't have a wife and didn't have anybody with whom he, during the years that they were together negotiating the treaty in France. The best record comes from John and Abigail.
Ironically, Jefferson and Adams later on did carry on quite a correspondence between the two of them.
Again, letters. There's no record that either of them assumed they would be saved.
But tell me about life as a soldier that you experienced, because as I said a minute ago, this book is not about heroes, it's about everyday grunts and what their existence is all about. It's not a book, as I said, about the fog of war. It's more about the cogs of war, which makes an army run.
Exactly. Because, I didn't see myself, I wasn't a hero, and I didn't want to be a hero. I was there. I wanted to do what I was asked to do, but I wasn't. But I was a routine soldier who was doing what he was expected to do, and doing it with pride. And I wanted to get back to Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us something about the routine that you experienced.
The routine, I think, is best described in the way I do, that a soldier is like a fireman. He's got to be terribly technically talented and courageous, but most of the time he sits around waiting for the bell to ring. Mm-hmm. And over the course of any soldier's career, even those who saw a great deal of combat really saw weeks of it or days of it. Nobody was at the front for years, and therefore you're trained for a very short period of time when the maximum is demanded of you. And I think I end up by talking about there, but for the grace of God go I, because the fact that I wasn't in the cemetery is because when an order came down that didn't include me or it sent me somewhere else, and I didn't, with one exception in my Army career when I got to Paris, I really was not very anxious to be killed, like most young people. Mm-hmm. But if that's what it was, that's what it was. I was there, and I had no choice. It's how did I go? Someone asked me, how did I have these assignments? And my answer was, after reveille, some guy blew a whistle and read from a clipboard and said, "You're in line."
I was interviewing earlier today someone from the Vietnam era, and he was talking about being there in 67, 68, when we had 550,000 soldiers and Marines there, and he made the comment that only about 150,000 of them were actually engaged in fighting. It took 400,000 to supply and service the 150,000.
I think the number is even more overwhelming in World War II, because supposedly the number is there between 11 and 12 million men in the Army, and less than a million actually saw combat. Now, there may be 2 million if you include I got a battle star for being in the Rhineland campaign, but not. I really was still not as defined. Combat today in World War II included the people who worked at the gasoline depot and worked in the hospital, and they were very near the front, and they were part of a combat unit. They weren't a rear echelon unit. But they really weren't in combat either. I was a long way from being shot.
A lot of it was routine and boring, you indicate, in many of these letters that you wrote home. Is that right?
That's correct. It was boring. And the training of a young college intellectual into a soldier is kind of requires a dulling of some of his instincts and his ambitions and to fit into a routine and marching every day till exhaustion and digging holes and learning to handle explosives and seeing somebody blow their hand off because they didn't handle them right and getting used to it so you feel at ease handling them. That requires constant training not to be smart, but to be follow orders and fit into a machine that's designed to win a war.
And you did just that. You were part of the machine. You also seem to me to have a number of privileges along the way. For example, how you got to attend some of the trials at Nuremberg astonished me.
Well, I did. I was very lucky. As I describe, I worked in a theater headquarters in Paris, Paris and later in Frankfurt. And really, I had a friend who was at Nuremberg, and between us, we arranged for me to attend. And I meant he got me in, and as I tell, I stayed with him at the Grand Hotel in Nuremberg, and I couldn't stay there. No enlisted men was allowed to stay there. I had to wear a sweater to cover up my sergeant's stripes to eat with the lieutenant who brought me there. And my commanding officer, everybody knew this was one of the great historic events of all time. I will just interrupt and say Parade Magazine recently ran a question on what were the greatest trials in history. And the answer was Socrates, Jesus, and Nuremberg.
That's a bliss, isn't it?
But be that's pretty exclusive company. But in any event, he knew it was a unique opportunity, and when he heard I might be able to go, he was perfectly willing to issue the orders and arrange for me to get to Nuremberg if my friend could get me into the trial and into the area.
What was your impression of the trial that you saw?
I was so impressed by how important Goering was. Goering, in the American press, was presented as a dope addict and a buffoon who weighed 250 pounds and was a gross person. History has shown that he was a man of considerable intellect, notwithstanding his obesity. And in the prisoner's dock, which is sort of the ultimate equalizer of men, all of the generals, the admirals, the shaks who ran the central bank all deferred to Goering in dealing with the lawyers for both sides. He was stripped of the trappings of rank. He clearly was a leader. And as I point out, it was subsequently shown that the chief allied prosecutor was Robert H. Jackson, who took a leave of absence from the Supreme Court to perform this role. And Jackson, who was a famed prosecutor in his day, decided that he personally would cross-examine Goering. Goering made a fool of him, and this has been in both the biographies of both. One of the questions he asked them was something about, was it true that he had participated in orders which involved the killing of 6 million Jews? And Goering answered, no different than you did with the Indians. And whether it's right, the accuracy of the statement doesn't make any difference. He had all the headlines in Europe the next day, and he knew he was going to die sooner or later anyway. Run trucks and tanks and jeeps, and gigantic quantities of gasoline. By the time I was involved.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012. Listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Our guest today is Herman Obermeyer, author of the recent book, Soldiering for Freedom, A GI's Account of World War II. When the war finally ended, you stayed on in Europe, spent quite a bit of time in France and in Germany. One of the things that really intrigued me about the book was your description of the French. In fact, you even titled a chapter, The War Against the French. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think, there are several aspects of it. One is that that the Americans knew very little about what I thought were strained or hostile relations between the French and the Americans, because we had very stringent censorship. And the dynamics of journalism then and now are that you cover the big strategy and you cover the boy back home. But what happens in a provincial city in Normandy, nobody cared about. So there was very little pressure from the press to break out of the restraints of censorship. And so there was very little printed about this. But I point out several things which make this why they didn't like us, and I'll get to why we didn't like them next. They didn't, you know, they capitulated to the Wehrmacht with virtually no battle. Less than 10 people were killed in the city of Rouen, a city of 109,000 people. However, the week before D-Day, we killed from the air twice as many soldiers as we lost on D-Day. Now, that means that they just can't like you very much. The Germans occupied them, and France was a coddled province of the Third Reich. And there's been a recent book written about Paris and the Third Reich, about how the racetracks kept going and the opera kept going. And the Germans were very anxious that this be a happy occupation over the long period. This would be an ornament in the provincial structure of the Reich. And so we killed all these people. How did we do it, and why did we do it? There's some explanation which makes a little sense, makes a lot of sense. Rouen was the rail center for all of Normandy. Therefore, wherever we landed, they were going to have to route the trains that would take back German troops and German supplies through Rouen. To bomb it long in advance wouldn't do any good, because you can rebuild rail lines. You had to bomb it the week before the landing, and but the Germans knew we were going to land, but they didn't know where. And therefore, we went over. Our bombers, actually the RAF chiefly, but Allied bombers, went over Rouen every night. And every night the Germans sent up flak and sent up fighter planes, because they knew we were going to go there. And every night, two or three bombers full of gas and bombs dropped out of the air, and a couple German planes too, and they dropped through apartment houses and warehouses and whatever, killing lots of people. And the French never quite understood why. And there's a similar story, although the statistics are slightly different. I couldn't confirm that it all took place in a week in Le Havre, which was the chief port of Normandy. And there we actually, they do have killing figures from us. We killed 5,000 out of 200,000. That's 2.5% of the population. How long a period, I'm not sure, because I can't confirm it. But when you add all that up, this is not, does not exactly encourage, brings warm feelings of the French to us, particularly when the Germans had been very good to them.
But on the other hand, as you point out, the French themselves were not only less than cooperative in many instances with the Allies, and particularly with many of the Americans, but they went out of the way to sabotage some of our operations.
Absolutely correct. I worked on it, and that's why I call the chapter Waging War Against the French. I worked on the gasoline pipeline, which the United States built from Cherbourg to the Rhine. And we actually started it on Utah Beach on D+2, because people do not realize that you can't run trucks and tanks and jeeps and airplanes without gigantic quantities of gasoline. By the time I was involved, they were using 1 million gallons of gasoline a day in 1945. And half of that had to be moved by pipeline, or we would have tied up the entire French rail system with tank cars.
I want to stop you right there, Mr. Obermeyer. We're going to take another break, and we'll continue this conversation about waging war against the French when we return on Veterans Chronicles.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiadin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest face.
Cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Our guest this week is Herman Obermeyer, author of Soldiering for Freedom, a GI's Account of World War II. And just before the break, Mr. Obermeyer, we were talking about your chapter, Waging War Against the French, and some of their efforts that were made that did not get reported in this country, to my knowledge, to sabotage, in particular, a pipeline that you had some responsibility for. But there were other instances as well, right?
Right. But I think that I want to finish the pipeline a moment because, as far as I know, I think I do know, it has been unreported with the exception of Stephen Ambrose, who in a paragraph mentions that the pipeline was sabotaged regularly. And Eisenhower, in Crusade in Europe, which may be the definitive book about the war, mentions the importance of the pipeline and that it didn't always perform as expected. He did not allocate the blame, as Ambrose did. So the French just assumed that they could open the pipeline and steal a little gas. And when you steal a little gas, if you don't close it up right, it bursts and our gasoline operation is totally stopped. Now, there were three parallel pipelines, so if one was out, there were probably two more operating at the same time. But I believe we probably lost 10% of the gasoline we were supposed to pump to regular breaks in the line, all of which were caused by the French. Now, whether it was sabotage or a poor peasant who wanted 5 gallons of gasoline for his tractor, I don't know. But I know that that poor peasant knew that if the line broke, they were only hurting one army, the Army of the United States of America. I meant between intentional sabotage and accidental sabotage, in my world, is a very narrow distinction.
Now that we've talked about the French, let's talk a little bit about the Germans and what you found and your impressions were once you got into places like Franklin and Frankfurt, et cetera.
You had the problem, among others, that American GIs consistently, and I wrote about it, liked the Germans better than the French. The German discipline appeals to Americans. We were in French cities like Rouen in January 1945 when the bombings of the previous June and September hadn't been cleaned up. There were streets that were covered with bricks. I was in Frankfurt in July of that year, and the Germans were out in an organized manner, probably the American soldiers making them do it, cleaning up the streets. The streets were clean. We'd bombed them more recently. We'd bombed them more completely, but the streets were clean. This appealed to Americans. But at that time, we had a non-fraternization law which prohibited Americans from having any contact with Germans, whether they be girls or homes, or you could have no social contact, a somewhat unrealistic law which was subsequently repealed. Albert Gore Sr., who was then a congressman, went over with to visit Germany with some group right after World War II, and wrote an op-ed piece and later introduced, got involved in potential legislation. They changed the rules first about non-fraternization, claiming this was requiring men to be abnormal.
Well, the list of prohibitions, as I recall from the book, things like don't be a sucker, there's no such thing as a good German,
right,
et cetera, et cetera.
We got a brochure, which I quote in the book, and which I, the original of which I've given to the National D-Day Museum in New Orleans, which said, don't be a sucker when you go to Germany. Everybody who went there. And as you say, it said that, and one of the things it said, which I think is terribly pertinent to what is going on in Iraq today, is if somebody in your town, your hometown, murdered a member of an occupying army, wouldn't he be a hero? That's a generic comment about the care and the relationship between an occupying army and indigenous people. And I think it is some of the conclusions we come to about Vietnam, about Iraq, are unrealistic, that this is part of the relationship between occupying armies. It is never welcome. We were not really welcomed in France because we were occupiers. And as I point out, for those who had a semi-classical education as I did, it took Caesar 1 year to conquer Gaul and 6 more to put down insurrections.
I understand that, but that seems to me all the more remarkable that there was so little resistance to be found in Germany.
That's true. But it also is because we were a strong occupying army. And it meant the victor was dealing with the vanquished. We were not liberators. We were victors. That's an entirely different concept.
Well, I appreciate that, but that still does not make invalid the comment that if someone kills somebody who is your victor or your vanquisher or your occupier, that he would be a hero to his own people.
Right. Well, that's, you know, whoever, you know, wrote this brochure, which was distributed to probably a million or 2 million or many millions of soldiers, because I actually have it in a couple of versions, because I went back and forth from Germany to France a couple of times, and every time you did it, you were given this, believed that this was essential advice, that they weren't going to like you.
German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. I repeat, the German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. There was no Allied confirmation.
To win the war, and we are going to win the peace that follows.
We do not yet know what will happen in France, or whether the French resistance will be prolonged, both in France and in the French Empire overseas. The French government will be throwing away great opportunities and casting adrift their future if they do not continue the war in accordance with their treaty obligation, from which we have not felt able to release in this struggle. However matters may go in France, or with the French government, or other French governments, we in this island and in the British Empire will never lose our sense of comradeship with the French people. If we are now called upon to endure what they have been suffering, we shall emulate their courage. And if final victory rewards our toils, they shall share the gains. I, and freedom shall be restored to all.
At some point, there must have been some thought given to exactly what the occupation was going to consist of. I know a lot of thought was given to it, but the Germans must have, at some point or other along the line, come to think that this was rather a benevolent occupation.
Well, they had a very harsh government. Therefore, the comparison is very important.
Right.
And, nowhere, and we must have been in some way superbly good occupiers. Today, in 2006, two of the great democracies in the world are Germany and Japan. Mm-hmm. We grew them out of ashes to be ornaments to society.
You spent a good deal of your career, if not most of it, in the newspaper business, and it seems to me that the way the press was reestablished in Germany after the war was a major contributing factor to the attitude that the German people took.
It was, but it wasn't very free. I mean, we actually controlled the press for a long time. We had a great deal of difficulty. I was not part of this, but I've been very interested. So we had a great deal of difficulty building staffs, because almost the only anti-Nazis on newspaper staffs before the war were communists. And therefore, we built them, and I meant there are people like Axel Springer who waged a good fight and became a scullionaire in the doing. But to build a press in Germany was a very complicated business, and Springer's a pretty good example of somebody we built upon. Mm-hmm. And it didn't just happen, and it really wasn't as free as it was calculatedly structured and then made free. I mean, again, we also understood that you had to create economically viable entities to be free. You can't give people the equivalent of writing a newspaper and then don't give them the necessary tools in which to distribute it and print it and sell advertising in it. The newspaper as we know it in the West is a capitalist artifact built on advertising.
But you've had a lot of experience in the last several years of trying to teach some of these same principles to newly emerging democracies in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Is there an appreciation there that it's got to be economically viable before it's going to even get printed?
It's a long teaching job. The answer is those who were brought up and achieved midlife as apparatchiks, I don't think learned very well. They weren't willing to learn their way. They're secure but meager life had been interrupted and changed, and they were not exactly helpful. The help came from those of a younger generation who believed that the future did lie in free newspapers and did lie in the free exchange of ideas. I think we had a long... Now, of course, in the scheme of history, it's only 15 years since the Soviet Union was dissolved on December 31st, 1991. Mm-hmm. So when I say it took a long time, I'm inclined to think maybe I'm a little impatient, that 15 years is a very short period of time.
Well, looking back over the last 55, 60 years and more, and having gone through obviously a great deal of time studying your own thoughts from that time, as expressed to your parents, what are your thoughts on reflection now about what you went through during the war and what has happened in the military since?
Well, the first answer is... I think it, on a purely personal and selfish basis, I think it just did a remark. It changed me from a dilettante intellectual to somebody who understood what he wanted to do with his life. And I am forever grateful for what I learned. And I think what I learned about patriotism is terribly important. I mean, I, 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 uh, I came to understand to participate in America in a way you never do unless you're forced to make some sacrifices and you're forced to know, do the introspection that's part of evaluating whether the risks of your life itself is really worthwhile. And along the line, you come to believe in it. And my patriotic passion was born partially of the questioning and resentment to some degree of here I am marching along. I'm tired every day. What am I doing? And so I think on a personal basis, changed my life in a way that nothing else has. And it took me a long time to understand that. I think a generation that hasn't experienced patriotism, who doesn't understand that you get nothing for nothing in this world, as they say. If you don't give to your country, you probably get less out of it. And I think I learned a lot.
Well, thank you for sharing your experiences with us. We appreciate it very much. And thank you also for a most, most interesting and thought-provoking book. Our guest has been Herman Obermeyer, author of Soldiering for Freedom, a GI's account of World War II. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center in association with Pellcom Communications. Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.